I'm Emily Thede, author of The Last Fenestra, coming in 2022 from Wednesday Books.
And I'm Anna, a teacher and a writer in the query trenches.
You're listening to Basic Pitches, where we...
Two basic pitches...
break down the basics of writing and being a writer.
Hello, Emily.
Hello, Anna.
And hello, Jade.
Hello.
We have a friend with us today. We're so excited to talk to you, Jade. How are you?
I'm much better for seeing your lovely, lovely faces.
Oh. Well, maybe we should talk about how we met, Jade. How we all...
Oh, yeah, I like to
do the connections thing.
Yeah, Jade, do you want to tell us, Jade?
How I met you two?
How we met? Yeah.
Well, for my sins, I actually entered Pitch Wars 2017. But I knew Anna before then... I can't remember.
Oh, I didn't know that.
See, this is the thing. I can't remember how I actually met you. All I know, it was probably
Twitter
just...
DMs go back.
Yeah, the most randomest Twitter interaction in the world or something.
Keep talking. I'm going to dive into our DMs.
You're going to be scrolling a long way.
Yeah,
probably like early 2016 or something. Anyway,
That's fun.
I read your book and loved it. You read mine. I presume you liked it enough to keep talking to me. and then we both entered Pitch Wars. I squeed when you got requests. And then we all kind of ended up in the class of 2017 together. And it's gone on from there in various stages.
We had a good bunch.
Yeah.
A lot of us have stayed in touch, maybe even more so than other classes.
Which is really wonderful. Before then, I started querying in 2014, and that's my first book. And everyone was saying, it's the community. It's the community. And I was like, no, that's just a cheap thing. No, that's just like a consolation prize. You get to meet people. Yeah, yawn. No. And I was just convinced that I just wanted the agent. I just wanted the publishing deal. I just wanted this. And then actually, through talking to people and making the right friends, I was like, it's the community.
It is now,
and it is very much part of my daily writing life. I don't know where I'd be without Anna, for instance. I don't know where I'd be without the class of 2017, just because I've made so many friends through there. And, you know, even like the other pitch contests, like we have a little group DM on Twitter called the Peppermint Crew. From another pitch thing that I got into, and we still talk to each other. That was 2016 too. So there's so many different nooks and crannies. But yeah, I met you guys through the editing, I think, crash course of Pitch Wars.
Yeah.
Because I'd never...
And then we all stayed in touch because we all did not instantly get launched to stardom. And that's when that community was really, really important. yeah, I think that was something too, is I remember thinking... that when people said, you know, the community is the prize, I felt the same way. I thought, well, they're just saying that because that they can guarantee you're going to meet people. But then I think I assumed a lot of that community and friendship making happened kind of during the Pitch Wars revision process. And I feel like that was sort of when we planted the seeds. But I really feel like most of my close friendships, it was kind of the showcase and beyond when – things got really emotionally intense and, you know, people were supportive of other people. Like there's just, Anna and I have talked about this before, but just like there's a special kind of friendship I think that forms when, you know, you're going through tough times. And for those of us who maybe didn't immediately get where we wanted to go after Pitch Wars, we needed that support so much more than we needed it even during the revision process. So I think it's wonderful.
I scroll back on Twitter so far that it glitched and brought me back to the present.
Yeah.
Like I was back in 2018 and still going. So there's that. There's that. No, I like the one thing you said, Emily, was the concept that you would make the friends during the contest itself. And I had always thought that too. And so by the time I was done with this rapid revision of just absolute hell for however long. How long did we have?
It was like so short. It was
like a month and a half.
It was so short. Yes. It's longer now, but it was intense.
Gosh. Okay.
So like
a month as well.
Ah!
Oh, you know what? It's because my mentor was traveling like the week that they announced mentees. So basically it was like, congratulations, you got picked. Here's your edit letter. So I had a little more time than most.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
It was wild. Yeah.
And, like, during that month, you don't have time to make friendships. Like, you really don't. Like, I don't know how anybody did if they did. Like you said, you planted those seeds. And then it was after that you, like, got back in contact with those people. Like, you really forged those connections. And
I think I had not realized this was me who did this. I was like, for years I've been saying, yeah, someone started a thread in our Facebook group saying we should swap manuscripts. And I looked back, like, recently, and I was like, oh, it was me. It was me who did that. Good job, me. But that was really crucial, too, because I remember we were all so nervous. And having this, it was just like, if you were willing to let people read your manuscript, you could post a little pitch or, a pitch in the first, kind of like your showcase entry sort of thing. And it was so great because it was just, I remember people would just go onto this thread and comment on books and be like, this sounds so amazing. I would love to read this. And it was like exactly the mood booster we all needed. And then also we all had full inboxes full of manuscripts that we didn't have time to read until after the showcase. But then it was really cool because it was like you started to then connect with people because you were reading their work. There was also, you know, the fun of reading the books that did immediately, like, get picked up by agents and got book deals. Mm-hmm. There was this kind of, like, camaraderie of, like, ooh, we got to read stuff early. And, like, we knew people before they were people. And I just think that was a really fun way to connect with people. Because when you read someone's work or when someone reads your work and you're kind of screaming at them about how much you love it, like, that's it's a really quick way to make friends. So, and yeah, I always say, too, that if someone had told me 10 years ago that I would get to be friends with some of my favorite authors, that I would, like, be in the acknowledgement section of books, like, that would have completely blown my mind. And so there were many times in the past few years before I got my agent, before I got my book deal, that when I would start to get really grumpy about how long it was taking, I would kind of remind myself, like, this is already cooler than you could have ever imagined. So, like, that really was kind of my consolation prize at times, was just to be like, hey, my book's not on the shelf. I don't know if it ever will be. Obviously, I do now know, unless something goes wrong. Hopefully not. But I still got to, like, see my name in the back of books and stuff, and that was really cool. So the community is great, but also, like, there are some fun little perks. You get to read stuff early and you get to be like, I know that person that's doing the book signing. So, yeah, thanks, Pitch Wars.
Right. That became a daily thing, like, after Pitch Wars, was to walk through the bookstore back when that was a thing and be like, I know that person. I know that person. I know that person. That person's really cool. That person was really nice to me on Twitter one time. That person.
Yes. It also my kids make fun of me because I'm like, I know them. I sort of know them. They know who I am. They might know my name. I don't know.
It's also a unique problem, though, with Pitch Wars and any other critique groups that you may be in. It's because not only are you friends with all these people who are brilliant and hopefully getting published and stuff, but you have to buy those books as well. Like,
oh my gosh, yes.
No, maybe about 7 or 8 people who are having their books out this year. And, you know, in the UK, it ranges from like £10 to £20, depending on whether they're paperback or hardback first. And it's just like, I love all of you, but I can't get all of the books at the same time. It's just, it's a unique and very privileged problem to have because I want to read them all. But it's just like, I just overwhelmed with the amount of talent that's coming at my face right now.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, right. Originally it was like, you know, the first time a book came out and I was like, I know this person. I mean, I was the first person in line at the bookstore. And I'm at this point where I'm like, I almost need to come up with like a system. Like, how well do I know you? How much, like, is this a genre I read? And it's like, I almost have like some books that I buy immediately, you know, in hardcover. And then other books that like maybe I don't know someone as well and it's not a genre I usually read. So I'll wait for the paperback or I'll get, you know, or I'll like do the ebook. Like, it's like I have all these tiers, which isn't like it's not a value judgment. It's just literally I realized I cannot have this many books in my house, which, again, great privilege to have. But it's true. It gets expensive to support all those friends. And then I realized that when my book comes out, I think they're going to send me like 20 copies of it. And I was like, I'm just going to need to just like make tables out of books. Like, what am I going to do with all these books? And I can never give any of them away because I'm like, these are my friends' books. I have to keep these forever. I just, running out of space and money for them. But yay.
What if we make our whole house libraries?
Yes.
Floor to ceiling.
Basically happening whether I mean to or not.
So Jade, tell us a little bit about what you write. So I think everybody knows by now, hopefully, that Emily and I write young adult fantasy. What do you write, Jade?
Ah, question of the century. In Pitch Wars, I got in with my young adult fantasy. This is how my brain works. I, for 7 years, wrote an adult urban fantasy when I didn't know how to write a book, which why it took me 7 years. I then had my young adult sci-fi, because I switched to young adult. I didn't know that was a thing, and then I fell in love with it. Then it was the YA fantasy for a few more books, and then I was like, you know what? I'm just going to try adult, because that seemed to be something that I felt more comfortable in, and my voice felt more comfortable in doing, and I could go darker and explore the themes that probably needed more time for me to think about, really. Not to say that you don't think about them in young adult, but there's a certain effortlessness with young adult that I don't think that I could achieve sometimes, because I just needed more time to kind of look at it in an adult perspective kind of way. But yeah, at the moment, historical fantasy seems to be my wheelhouse in the adult vein. The weirder, the better. I kind of recently realized my themes are more, well, not my themes, but kind of like, you like the books if you like your heroes to come with a little bit of blood on their hands. And if...
Yes.
and I was like, if I like do. It,
hi. Yeah, that's my brand.
A little bit of complexity and not all good. I love Morally Gray. But I tend to write my girls as very fierce and the men as more cinnamon rolls. And I don't know whether that's a conscious decision, but that's just kind of how they come to me. Apart from the next one, which I'm still kind of coming to grips with now.
And are you planning to query again anytime soon, you know?
Yes. As soon as Anna has her wonderful eyes over the manuscript here, and then I'm going to revise. I call my books by their main characters. So Castra is now with Anna. As soon as she tears that apart, I'm going to try and stitch it back together again. And then I'm going to try and query. I have spent over maybe 2 years working on Castra.
Wow.
My original idea was to query last year. And we all know how 2020
was. I can't imagine why this year would have thrown wrenches.
Right. Weird thing. Like, suddenly the world stopped. And so did my brain. So I was like, you know.
Yes.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. It took me no time at all to draft and revise this book.
Yeah, I'm usually a fast drafter. I usually write a first draft in about, 6 to 8 weeks. I like to just, fly through it, and then I revise in, four or 9 months.
What is your life?
Because, again, they're terrible. It's an exploratory draft. And I usually – I started with NaNoWriMo. That was the first time I had ever tried to write. So, for me, I'm sort of a, momentum writer. I have to go. I just have to, put down as many words as possible, and that's what kind of gets my brain going with ideas. And this year, no. Nope.
Just no.
Nope. As soon as I sold my book back in March, I was like, okay, I need to start working on the sequel because it's a 2-book deal. And I basically have, squeezed out about 30,000 words over the past 9 months, 10 months. And, most of them are repeats. I'll write a scene and then I, forget I kind of wrote it and I sort of write. It's not. It's been hard. Ooh. It's been rough. Never got the momentum. But that's kind of what we're talking about today, right? We're talking about getting into new projects and how do we do that? The eternal question.
I have nothing because I always listen. I don't know if it's common, but every time, I shared this with you guys before we started the episode, which is that every time I get to the end of a book, I'm about to revise and query this one. It's like, I'm so excited. I'm going to revise and query. It's so great. And then as soon as that happens, my brain's like, what about your next project? And I, the record scratches, the brakes squeal, and then it's like, what if I never write another word again? What if we're done? And I don't know how to get started, so.
Yeah. It's hard. I like revising. And then that, I think that really hard fall from the top when you polished something and every word is where you want it to be, and then it's like, oh no, now I have to have the sludge all over again because, yeah. Yep. My first drafts used to be unreadable. Like, typos, grammatical, like, just a mess. Like, it was a word salad. Mm-hmm. And now they've gotten a lot cleaner, but what it does then is sometimes it tricks me, like, because I'll just look at the words and I'm like, it's not so bad. And then I try to, like, actually look at the story and it's like, oh, gosh. Okay. I have to start picking everything apart and putting it back together. And it's just, it's daunting at the beginning.
Yeah. So what... I mean, I'm trying to think, honestly, like, how do I start a new project? And I think what I'm going to do is different than what I've done in the past because, again, we've talked about how I'm, like, an outliner. Like, you both know beyond a shadow of a doubt how bad of an outliner I was for a long time. Like, I've even got this, like, nervous hand.
How that's devoted, like, devoted, dedicated.
Yeah, okay, a very dedicated to that outline. And I'm going to try not to do that just like I did with this one. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do we want to talk about, like, from conception to, like, concept to, I know, like, like, talk about it from conception to, like, the actual book? Like, what?
Yeah, like, what, just what that process looks like. Because I find it's different for every book, which is, like, people say that a lot, and it's like, well, how can that make sense? Like, you learn a process. No, like, there are books where I have, you know, like I said, fast drafted it and then just shredded it into pieces and built it from the ground up. There was one book, the one that made it into Author Mentor Match for me, that I, like, woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning with a book idea and, like, the whole story in my head. And I got up the next morning and I tried to outline it. And I ended up having to spend more time revising that book than any of the sloppy messes that I'd done before because, like, it just didn't, like, the outline I came up with made sense in my head, but then when I wrote the book, it didn't work well, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, for me, my one true attempt to outline did not make it any easier to revise, which was the promise, right. The promise I was given. If you start with a plan, it'll be easier to make it read. Nope.
It's a lie. It's a lie. No, it works for some people, but for me, it's a lie. What do you do, Jade?
Basically... That's my process.
All right, this is
that's great. My process. It is different with every book. And I think it's every book you're trying to get to know how best you can work. It's not a case of cut and dry, this will work perfectly for me this time, because as your books evolve, you and your life will evolve. I think you'll have different times of, you know, stress and things will, like, I don't know, 2020 happens in your life. But I tend to have my next book idea, sometimes even two book ideas, while I'm meant to be finishing a draft of the one I'm currently on. And I know that's the shiny new idea that Victoria Schwab tends to put into words better than I can probably put into. But for instance, when I was finishing or desperately trying to finish off Castra, I knew the next one that I was going to work on, and that was my next 1920s Oxford sort of murdery one, and I was cooking that. I started writing that first, and then I went, no, I'm going to write Castra. So I already had an idea of what that would be, but then I kind of stewed it in the back of my head, and then as I was finishing Castra going, yes, I can't wait to get onto the next one after this is done, I had a new one here, and I was like, obsessed with it. I'm still obsessed with it. And it really is annoying because I can see it so perfectly in my head, but I have to say, no, down, like, just get away, put it in a drawer, keep it there, even though it's screaming to get out, and try and focus my energy on this one. And I suppose because of the issues of maybe previous years and stuff, I worried that I had lost the spark for this current work in progress, this current whip, because I was, I don't feel the characters anymore. I've been stewing this since 2018, and all I can think about is this new idea. So I had to kind of recalibrate and re-examine, go to all my Pinterest boards, go back to all of the original inspiration, the notebooks that I'd written down all this stuff in, to remind myself why I was so excited to write this one in the first place. And so I'm really happy that I actually do have it. And I'd already written like 20,000 words of it before I switch projects. But it was just a case of just finding where your head's at. And I think some books you have to go through before you can write the one that you were going to tackle first.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, amen. Yes. So I'm in church. Amen. Listen to me. I'm like, yes.
Well, I don't tend to go to church in case I burst into flames. But yeah, it's just one of those things where like outlining was not a thing that I knew of. The most outlining I did was my wife, sci-fi. I just wrote a general outline of what I wanted to do in the plot. And halfway through, I completely forgot about it and went somewhere completely different. And the confidence I had in writing that book was, compared to my first one, was just ridiculous. That was the fastest I'd ever written. And then the more I learned how to write a book, and the more I learned, you know, about the craft and through pitch wars and everything, the less sure I became in, is this a good idea?
Yeah.
Is this going to be any good?
Was that the Dunning-Kruger effect? Where, like, the less you know about it, the more you think you're an expert, and the more you learn, the more you're like, oh, no.
Yes.
Always more to learn.
I love that
you have to, you know, put things on. I think Victoria Schwab talks about the back burner. She keeps things simmering on the back burners. Because I always loved that concept. And yet I find for me, I'm often the opposite. That if I do put something to simmer, then I don't have the momentum. You know, like I said, I'm kind of someone that needs to just like hit the ground running and go as fast as I can. Because if I stop, I lose it. Like I'm that way with everything. Like I love exercising when I do it every day. If I stop doing it, I never want to do it again. Like it's just very much for me, it's just a like, kind of keeping that forward motion, which is, I also respond really well to like deadlines and self-imposed deadlines and pressure and all that stuff. And so it can be a transition, strangely enough, once you actually do things like get a book deal, because suddenly the timelines stretch out really far, depending on like options clauses and stuff. If you, like in my case, I have a 2-book deal, which is amazing, like not complaining about that, but it means that we're going to be working on these books, you know, for the next year or so. And I started working on The Last Fenestra in very early 2019. You know, I worked on that for a year and a half. I got a book deal and then I revised it and then I'm working on the next book. And it's such a change of pace for me to spend so much time on one thing when I got in this kind of groove of like, you write it, you revise it, you query it, you write it, you revise it, you query it, you write it. And now it's like, okay, now I need to figure out how do I hit the ground running when I know that anything I work on is probably going to have to like hang out on my computer for a while until I can actually potentially go out on submission. So it's just funny and fascinating to me that all brains work so differently.
I think the one thing that you said, Jade, that like resonated with me, forgive me. I've never had that before. So the thing that you said that resonated with me is the going back and finding the spark, because that is in, and I can't remember what it's called, and I'll find it and I'll put it in there, or I'll talk about it in the credits or whatever. But she talks about the spark of a book, and it really resonates with what you're talking about, Emily. Like she is very much like once a project has her attention, she needs to feed it, and it's almost like a fire. You need to feed it, or eventually that fire won't die out. She has this theory that like they go to other people, right? Where you're like the thing that happened to you, Emily, where it's like, wait, I wrote that concept, yeah. I wrote that book or whatever. We all do that, where it's like, yeah. But I had an idea like that, and it's like, your idea just kind of like transferred over to that person and was like, well, you're not going to feed me. I'm going to go somewhere else. But I think the idea of going back to that spark is also part of an outlining process too, is figuring out those scenes, is saying what caught my attention? What was so exciting about this that I had to write it, that this became a story? And I think it's different for everyone, just because she's on the brain. Victoria Schwab, she talks about for A Darker Shade of Magic, it was an image of Kel, right, in his red coat. That was all she had.
Yeah.
And that's all she started with.
One of the best lines of any book ever.
I know. And to me, that would never happen. I don't see characters. I see like those like epic scenes 3/4 of the way through the story where it's like, oh, that would be dope if this thing happened where this character turned on this character, and that would be – and then I have to work backwards. So I think it's all about finding that spark and then working from there.
Mine is usually a combination of a very, very broad premise and a character want, but not the character itself. Like for The Last Fenestra, it was sort of this – it sounds like I wrote it after COVID, but I did not. The concept of a character kind of desperately wanting human connection and having that be deadly for her. And then sort of like, what would a society, basically, you know, if I have this character who really wants to be close with people and she can't because she kills everyone she touches, poor girl, then how do I build a society that makes it worse in every possible way? You know, how do I make a society that is so built around connection and community, but also put her in a situation where, because of her role in society, she is completely isolated in every way? And it's like, I start with that basic concept and that one character thing that they want, which obviously is like diametrically opposed to the world. And then it's a lot of, you know, chasing the spark around, I think. You know, I loved what Jade said about, you know, Pinterest boards and stuff. We always joke around in the writing world that we're, you know, we're not wasting time. This is part of the work, but it is part of the work. And it's like, whatever it is, that image or that character dynamic or even like an actor and actress that inspires something, it's just like, how do you kind of keep feeding that little flame so that it doesn't burn out until you have time to figure out the rest of the story?
I'm quite visual myself. I like studied, I wrote books before I studied film for 5 years, but I do, even like when I was younger, I would write based on the scenes that were playing out in my head.
Yes.
And I used to sit alone in the dark with the Lord of the Rings soundtrack going on, like maybe some fairy lights or something, and just come up with these scenes and trailers and, you know, various different things. And that was kind of my method for a while. But the original sparks of the ideas for things just come from the weirdest places.
Yeah, like,
I couldn't really revisit the original concept idea for the current work in progress, because that was the Queen's speech. And I didn't really want to go back and watch a Queen's speech from like years ago. It was just the really briefest thing of, oh, okay. And just having this idea that came to me from nowhere. And like, my YA sci-fi was me watching, I think it was a video game trailer, and going, oh, what if that was this? And it was a what if concept. And
yeah,
like, Castor is based on my hometown and the fears that I had when I was little. And the theatre that I grew up around and stuff. So that's completely different. And I think that as long as you can connect with the feeling and the, if you are visual, you know, anything that you grab, like if I go on Pinterest and I see like an image of a guy in front of a house, that can inspire another scene for that thing.
Yeah.
If it looks atmospheric and similar, then I can do that. And it's just a case of finding what works for you to ground yourself back into the, I'm writing this because this is what it meant to me at the time, and, you know, the original conception, you know.
Yeah. When I hit writer's block, the first thing I do is give myself permission to read a bunch of books, even if they have nothing, even if they're completely out of my preferred genre, and watch a lot of movies and watch a lot of TV shows. Because it's like you said, you have no idea what that thing is that's going to give you an idea of something, but if you're not exposing yourself to other things, you know, and right now we're all kind of stuck at home. It's not like we can travel around in search of inspiration. But if you're reading other people's books and you're watching other people's movies, you know, one of those completely unexpectedly might be the thing that kicks off your next idea.
Right. And I think once you have that idea and something, just to try and like find some like forward momentum with this, is once you have that idea, one of the things that I have heard that's been so helpful to me is to write down as much as you know about that concept and then let it sit for a minute. And then I tend to come back and look at it and say, okay, why did I like this? Why did I write this a week ago? And what parts of this do I like? And then anything that doesn't transition over needs to go away. Like, that wasn't the thing that's exciting. Those are the, like, extraneous details. I want only these things. So it's like, I really love this because of Enemies to Lovers. I really love this because of the setting that reminds me of my hometown. I really like this for this topic of discussing this dark theme or this theme in general. And then everything builds off of those pillars. And I forgot where I've learned that from. It's not in my own brain. And I want to say it's a podcast of some sort. But yeah, that's something like to consider, is like, again, keeping that spark throughout the entire drafting process, is saying, okay, what did I like about this? What am I trying to accomplish? What's fun for me? What's going to be? And like, I think at that point you are writing what's fun for you. you're not thinking about someone else reading it.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. The longer you can make it through at least the drafting process without trying to think. Like, you know, people always say you have to think of your audience. Yeah, but for me, that's revision. That's how you pitch something. That's, but when you do have that spark, I think it's so crucial to chase it around for yourself to find it. Because otherwise, you just start tripping over yourself and trying to do what you think other people are going to want. And you can finish the book, but have killed the spark, which is not something you want to do at that phase or whatever.
Right.
And your first audience is you anyway.
Yep.
You're the one that's having to read it every day. But, you know, if you edit as you go like I do. You know, you have to read it first. And to be honest, if you like it, which is probably arguably the most important, you, other people will as well. Because, for instance, you're not the only person who loves your favorite book. There will be other people mm-hmm. who love your favorite book, like The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue is one of my current favorites. And I'm not the only one to love that book. But no. Victoria Schwab had to first love that book enough and the concept of it to believe in it enough to write it. Mm-hmm. So if you have the same feeling about that and something compels you to write it, the power of words compel you, and just write it out. Do it as much as you can. I think that's something that I'm having to learn is just like, I'm not a speed drafter by any stretch of the imagination. I try and just kind of almost channel it psychically, just connect to something and just let the words flow out as much as I can. But the other day I was talking to Anna and I said, next door decided to bang the crap out of their walls when I was just sitting down to write. And I was like, this is the first time in weeks I wanted to write this thing. So I just forced myself to sit. I thought, leave them off in the background, just focus on the words on the page. And I got through it. I managed like 1,200 words. It was feeling really good. I didn't know where the hell that scene was going to go, but I just knew that the words were down there because I also write out of order. So yeah, I think that I'm probably chaos when I'm writing my draft, but it works for me. And thank the Lord for somebody introducing me to Scrivener and telling me that it's there.
I got to be the ambassador for Anna, like, in this past
year. It's so good.
Because, Anna was such a linear writer, and I feel like I coaxed you out of the dark side a little bit, which, you know, we've talked about on this podcast before.
I needed it.
Whatever method works for you is great, and I think when you get stuck, try something different.
Right. I will be the first person to support anybody who wants to outline their books. You do it. I'll support you. But I also will totally admit that I am done with that mess for right now. Now, that's not to say that like a book in the future, and this is like talking about how every project is different. Some books require like a strict outline. Like there are several people who, several authors who they were like, one, my book that's published, I totally pants the whole thing, had no idea where I was going. And then their second book that they're working on, they're like, this has to have an outline. Like my brain functions this way right now. Like I have to know what happens next to be able to keep going. And I think that also ties in with what you said earlier, Jade, about it's not so much about the project itself, but it's about where you're at in your own personal life. You know, you may not have the energy, the time, the brain space, the whatever, something in your life may say, you don't have time to just like pants this. You don't have the, you know, the energy, the creative juice to do that, but you do have the creative juice to write this outline and to hit this chapter. And I think that's so important too. So just kind of like listen, check in with yourself, like mentally, physically, and say, where am I at? What do I need?
The one I'm doing at the moment, it requires an outline. And I have tried, but until I think write all the scenes that are alive in me and that are fully formed and like the scenes of a movie, until I know I've written them down, I can't connect them, I don't think.
I'm the same way. Very much the same way. I do that.
That's
I
tell myself, Clay method.
Yeah, I do a lot of telling myself. I say telling myself stories, but it's not words. It's like Jade said, it's very much watching the scenes play out as kind of like my bedtime routine, like when I'm trying to fall asleep because I have what I call a busy brain. I do have ADHD, and all my life I've known that my brain was busy, but I didn't know what it was. But the point is just that I don't understand how some people can lie down and not think about stuff. Like there's always going to be something happening in my head. And so for me, even as a really young kid, it was sort of writing stories, telling stories, but really kind of watching my little like imaginary home movies in my head. And those scenes, sometimes there'll be one scene that I just, it's like every night as I'm falling asleep, I'm replaying it and I'm changing the dialogue and I'm changing the interactions. And it just, then it does get to a point where it's like so clear that I can write it really fast. But a lot of those scenes do start sort of disjointed. And sometimes I think the trick is just to get it down on the page. Mm-hmm. Because I know for me, once I can see, okay, there are enough words here to kind of sort of be a story, even if they're not in order, even if I haven't found all that kind of connective stuff, it gives me the motivation to do all that hard work because there mm-hmm. is something there to work with.
Well, I have a question because both of you are my kind of muses right now. So what happens if you have like a story and you know there's like five different versions as to how that story can go. How do you possibly, because at the moment I'm like, right, so this scene could happen either in the middle, near the beginning, or right at the very end. It could happen in a mythological book too that may never come. You know, how do you decide which order is the right order? Because, oh, don't hide from me. Anna is curling her cardigan around herself.
Because Anna and I, when we once, we had a conversation about maybe a year, no, 2 years ago, where I basically had said I was trying to outline, but like I kept realizing that like this scene I thought was the midpoint was actually the break into act two. And Anna did a great job of being tactful and kind of being like, I don't really understand. And how that is possible.
It was the most, like, if there's anything in our friendship that Emily could drag me for being, like, not a good friend, it was when she was like, I'm trying to decide, like, where these scenes go. And I'm thinking about moving something from, like, the 70-point mark to, like, the 10% mark. And I was like, how the hell does that happen?
But it does. It does. Especially a lot of times for me, like, you know, we talk to writers a lot about how, like, you can cut the first three chapters. Like, people tend to start too slow. Like, writers, often we have to kind of, like, get, like, a slow ramp up, you know, so that we can learn the story. But then it's, like, turns out you don't actually need that first 50 pages. You can chop it off. And so there's this shifting that happens. But so that's, for me, that's Scrivener. That's when I put those scenes in a place. And so what I'll do is, once I do have a couple of those signpost scenes that I'm, like, I'm confident this is my inciting incident, I mean, I'm confident this is going to be a big thing that happens later. The ones that I do know what order they have to go in, I put them in order first. And then I start looking at things like pacing. You know, I'll do things like I'll color code mm-hmm. scenes by, are they an action scene? Are they a dialogue scene? Are they whatever? Because a lot of the time for me, those fun, juicy scenes that I don't know where they belong are like bantery scene, or it's a subplot, you know, there's another character interacting with the main characters, but it's not directly tied to the main plot, and that's why it's fuzzy where it belongs. There is a scene in The Last Fenestra that this is probably the scene that made Anna side-eye me. It's a secondary character who, you know, commits a betrayal of sorts. And originally when I wrote the story, it seemed like such a horrible thing to happen that it felt very darkest moment-y. And I think I scooted around so much and it ended up being a little after the midpoint because it was an important moment, but it wasn't actually one of those key moments once I had figured out the main plot. Mm-hmm. But yeah, every time I moved it around to the point where I would forget where I had put it, you know, because I revised and just pulled the story apart so many times. But yeah, that's my only real advice on that is to figure out which scenes have to happen in a certain order. Then see if you can pinpoint which ones are those big, big moments, you know, like, because there are certain things like they can't talk about this if they haven't done that yet, that just have to be in order. But once you have them in order, that's when I really get out those beat sheets and I say, okay, this is a really important one. This is a smaller important one. And it's kind of like once I can see that framework, then I start to see where I can use those fun, juicy scenes and stick them in various places.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say, was the after you have enough, like you've talked about clay, right? Mm-hmm. After you have enough of these scenes and you know, like instinctively, you know, and it could change in revision, but for this draft, and I think that's something that I've tried to convince myself is think of it as this draft, I know for me right now, and it may change later, but this is the inciting incident. This is the midpoint. And then like you said, move them around. And I think that's when you can pull out that outline. And I'm using like the bunny ear quotation there. Mm-hmm. Is like that outline is to move it around in Scrivener and say, okay, inciting incident. And actually like label
that's
the
what
scene,
I do.
Inciting incident. Yeah.
Yep.
And label it those beat sheets. So inciting incident, break into plot two, or midpoint, whatever it may be.
Love a beat sheet.
Yeah, and whatever beat sheet works for you. So you know, like, okay, this is the darkest moment. This is the midpoint. This is the whatever. And then at the bottom, you have all these extra scenes that you've written. Then you can start to go through those and label and move them and kind of, like, tuck them where they belong. And it's okay if, like, the scene where this one takes place, like, if this scene that you've written down here, this dialogue takes place in a weird place.
Yeah.
It's okay. You can change that. You can change that when it's up here, but that conversation can move there. So that's
kind
of what I did with this book.
That's always a wild one, too. Like, there'll be a scene maybe where, like, a character learns something important. So, like, the dialogue is conveying information, but, like, originally it's, like, a funny bantery scene, and then I realize, like, oh, no. Now it happens here, and those two characters don't like each other there, so I have to, like, change the phrasing just so it's the same conversation but with an entirely different like mood behind it, which is always tricky but fun. I have a big whiteboard actually that I took like kind of like electrical tape, and I basically made like a big kind of beat sheet on it. And so I've written in like inciting incident at, you know, 10% mark and midpoint at this, and I've written all those things. And then what I will do is I will get, you know, little note cards or magnets or something. And I do exactly that. The scenes that I know where they have to go, which usually is not that many, gets written in, you know, a wet erase marker that's harder to take off. And then the other scenes that have to go in order, but I don't necessarily know exactly where they're going to fall, I will lay those down and I do exactly that. And then I have all those extra scenes kind of lying around. And then I look at it and I say, okay, well, I've got a whole lot going on here, or maybe this section is packed already. It's already too long for how long this book needs to be. So maybe this fun kind of secondary scene with this other character, maybe I can fit that in a part that's a little sparser. But it's, yeah, that's why all the work for me is in revision. I've just drafted as fast as I can, and then I have scenes everywhere and I need to figure out where they go.
I think
it's a lot.
Yeah, with Castra, because I didn't outline at all, I just kind of did a thing where the end of it, because I was like, how am I going to revise this? I have no idea how I'm going to revise this. I kind of went back through it, scrolled back through the document, and made notes. And I think this is really handy if you are stuck staring at the computer. Take time to engage the different part of your brain and just write out something in hand form, because that will engage something different.
Totally.
And I just kind of wrote down everything that happened. And as I was writing down everything that happened, how I put it out, I was like, ooh, no, that happens in the wrong place. And then I could just kind of make a note at the side or on like a printed outline that I'd written of what happened as well. And just say, no, we need to move this up. We need to shift this down. Something needs to happen to bridge these two here. And I could see the massive gaps between like what happened here and what needs to happen here.
Yep.
So I think it's just a case of, you know, you can completely restructure it when, at any stage, really. I am very fortunate that I have never, or maybe just because I'm stubborn, I've never completely disregarded a manuscript to rewrite it from scratch. But
I don't either.
No, I
will revise it. I will tweak it. I will change it. But I have never just like tossed something out and started over. Not even with most scenes. There are scenes that I have ended up cutting entirely, but I've never rewritten a scene from scratch, which is kind of terrifying when I think about the fact that I am such a kind of chaotic drafter. And then I still, in a way, am sort of wed to those words. Like, but it's like I basically will do, I'll rearrange them so much that in the end it's totally different. And I should have just rewritten it. But it's just something about, like, it's the clay versus not having the clay. I need to have something to move around and work with. But I know Anna and I have also talked about how once you start doing that, pinning things in place and looking at the extra scenes, a lot of times, for me, I discover that a bunch of them serve the same function, that they can be combined. Or one of my other favorite tricks is if I have a couple scenes that feel a little too similar, like in tone or mood, I'll change the setting. Or I'll add another character into the mix, or I'll just do things to make sure that I don't have too many scenes that feel too similar. And a lot of times I don't realize that I have too many scenes that feel too similar until I do until they're sitting there in a pile next to my kind of pseudo outline. And then I realize it.
That's something I get to in revision. Like, I can't wrap my head around that until I'm, like, reading through the draft as it is whole. And then I'm like, oh, wait, we've had, like, 10 kitchen scenes back to back. Guess I should fix that. Oops.
I also get too attached to, like, simple dialogue. And then I think, oh,
yep.
How can I fit this dialogue into this scene? And trying to set the scene around, like, some kind of words that I put. Just change the words, delete them. You don't have to have it like this. And it's a similar thing where I was writing it too sequentially. Like, this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. And I thought, you could save 30 pages, and I did. If you would just squish this thing that happens within the 30 pages into one room where they're all together at the same time and just talking to each other. And so I did that, and it really sped up the pacing, and it was just like, don't get too married to the idea that it has to be, just throw it in. Like, I've just, I'm still
emotionally. That's like telling yourself it's the clay, it's not the finished product, it's just the material.
Will you all remind me of this? Will you remind me of this when I start my next draft?
We will keep reminding each other, because every writer forgets it every single time.
Because I will come to both of you and be like, it's not working and I can't write. And you'll be like, Anna, we made a podcast about this specifically. Go listen.
Go listen to it. Well, my my agent was an editor before becoming an agent. So she is, you know, we talk about agents being editorial and non-editorial. She's very editorial, like very, very editorial. And my big revision with her, which, you know, Anna got to listen to got to read typed messages of me flailing just a little bit because my agent was brilliant, and everything she said was true, but also it did not feel possible. You know, it was a lot of like, can we get to this faster? Can we get to this faster? Can we move this sooner? Can we, you know, and she would point out, you know, they just had a conversation in this room a few pages ago. Why don't you cut one scene? And I got very like, I will not murder my darlings. I will save my darlings. I will find a way to save my darlings. And a lot of it was exactly that. It was taking little bits of dialogue and putting them into a scene that was more active that I already had. So I was, you know, like cutting up all these scenes into little tiny pieces and like sprinkling them throughout other things, because she was right. There were too many similar scenes, but I wasn't willing to give up some of that dialogue. And I'm actually really glad that I didn't, because it was one of those situations where the advice was the problem was absolutely true. Like, she was 100% right. But in my stubborn refusal to just cut stuff, it really pushed me to figure out how to make every scene and every line count even more. And it just did wonders for my pacing. And that's like my favorite thing to help people with now when people are working on pacing is, you know, look at those scenes that feel similar. How can you combine them? Look at the dialogue that you love. Can you put it in another scene that you already have to just kind of squish and condense? That's more fun than drafting, at least for me.
I love it.
But it's that spark. I think that's kind of what we were saying in the beginning, is you have those scenes or those bits of dialogue that get you excited every time, then they're not just darlings. Then they might be the heart of the story, but you still have to figure out how to make them do the most work.
Right. I think Jade named our episode by calling it The Spark.
Yes, The Spark. Named it.
Yay. Because that's what it is. Like, that's all it is just finding the spark and feeding that spark. Like, is this what you want, Spark? Do you want best friends turned enemies turned lovers? Like, what do you want, Spark?
Always. And
then chase it all every time.
See, this episode now has convinced me that I should go and let myself play with a book idea that is not my sequel.
I said, I think it was one of the, again, Victoria Schwab should pay us for mentioning her so much. It was on one of her,
we love you, Victoria.
Yeah, author conversations. And one of them said that they have to have two projects at the same time, because if, you know, they're stuck on something in one project, if they play another one, their mind will continue to try and solve the problems as they're creating another thing, and then they'll have the solution. So I do tend to have two projects ruminating on the go, at least.
Yeah, so I have to have one I'm revising and one I'm drafting. At least I used to do that a lot, because they're such different processes.
Do you ever hear, like, people in your field talk about something and everybody's like, yes, I do the same thing, and then you're the only person there that's like, I'm an imposter?
Me every time I hang out with plotters.
Okay, cool. Because I'm sitting here going, I don't really know. Like, I think there's always this moment of chaos where it's like I kind of get an idea towards the end of revising something. It's almost like my brain has enough space to be like, okay, here's this idea. Like, do a thing with it. And then I spend about a month and a half feeling like I don't know what I'm doing anymore and I don't know how to feed this project. And then finally something clicks and it happens. So this whole like working on something while working on something else.
But that's your process.
It's terrifying you.
You know, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, okay, just because I have an ideas book with 43 ideas in it and more to come probably in the next 2 days.
Good Lord.
It doesn't matter, you know?
Send some of those sparks out into the universe because...
I was going to say, Jade, stop thinking about some of those sparks. Let them transfer.
Let them go. Share that. Let them go. You're hogging all the sparks.
I know.
Excuse me, Emily, Anna, why don't you have another book you're working on? Jade's it's because Jade little. Has all the sparks.
I know.
That's very cool.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This has been fun. Normally we play a game at the end where the person has to pitch their book badly, like pitch what they're working on badly. So like make it super boring.
I could just give you the Twitter pitch that I tried.
Honestly. I'm sure it's not bad.
No!
Okay.
If it helps, I can try and do mine. I haven't done mine.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to see, it's hard enough trying to make it good. And trying to make it bad now is really like an extra challenge. Singer, scared of the dark, flame boy, starts feelings.
Nice.
Yes! I love it. I love it so much. All
right, Anna, what you got? Grumpy boy doesn't appreciate good cooking. No.
I was about to say murder boy needs cold killer. Gets sugar plum fairy instead.
I love it. I love it.
See, I would have gone with something like along the lines of soggy bottoms somewhere in there, but
perfect. We should write each other's bad pitches.
This is great.
Midboy experiences soggy bottom. Needs somebody to rectify.
Ooh, next girl up, we're going to have to start coming up with taglines. That'll be our next challenge.
Well, Jade, it was fun having you on the podcast. We're so excited to talk to you.
I was really excited to talk to you, too. I haven't spoken to anybody in months. It's been great. <I
know. laughs> Oh, quarantine.
The thing is, I'm almost annoyed that it's not 2020 anymore, only because I got so used to being like, ugh, 2020. And now I'm like, ugh, 2020. Like, we just need, like, a word for the past 12 months that encompasses it, you know?
We're in purgatory.
And episode ends. We're in purgatory.
Yeah, we're like, that's it. That's the last line. We're in purgatory.
Everyone, thank you again for listening to another episode of Basic Pitches. We super appreciate you popping by. Another thing you should pop by is Jade's Twitter account. You can find her on Twitter at Jade M. Loren. That is spelled J-E-D-E-M-L-O-R-E-N. She has a fantastic editing service, which we did not talk about, but I want to definitely plug here. She's wonderful. You'll want to like get her on your side for your manuscript, your query, or whatever it is you need. Remember to add The Last Fenestra on Goodreads, and also check out Jelly Nell on Etsy. She made our cover. She's fantastic, does excellent jewelry. I think that's it. I'll see you next week. Bye, pitches!